This is the Passive Real Estate Podcast, the premier podcast for passive real estate investors. Matt Jones interviews experienced passive investors who share their industry secrets and active investors who show you different ways to invest passively. Welcome back. I'm Matt Jones. And today on the Passive Real Estate Podcast, I welcome Paul David Thompson. Welcome, Paul. It's great to have you on the show.
Matt, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Absolutely. What would you like the audience to know about yourself?
Well, I'm a former corporate drone. I was in the matrix in the corporate America, and now I have used real estate as a way to escape that rat race and have control of my time in such a way that I no longer have to exchange my time for money anymore. And now I exchange my dollar for time, my dollars for time.
Excellent. Excellent. And how did you get started with real estate investing?
Well, my very first investment was in 2015. I was working in the corporate world and I wanted to find a way outside out of having to earn that income just to make ends meet. So I started by dabbling and running a little experiment. I bought a single family house in Little Rock, Arkansas, where I live. And it was, I think I bought the thing for like $30,000 and put $10,000, $15,000 into it. And when I got that first paycheck or the first rent check, I was like, this is how it's going to work. Like I was bit by the bug at that point that I saw that, okay, this is how you replicate yourself without having to always exchange that time for money at a job.
Excellent. Yeah. 30,000. Oh my gosh. I couldn't even imagine a house for 30,000 right now.
But right now, even in Little Rock, it'd be hard to find a house in a decent neighborhood that's anywhere close to that.
Indeed. And then how did your investing develop after that single family?
It developed quite a bit. So I went down a path of going down single family, and that was my strategy. And I bought from wholesalers at first and tried my hand at property management, realized I'm terrible at property management. Tenants are incredible negotiators and I'm not. And I'm too much of a softy. So I had to basically remove myself from interacting with the public because they would use and abuse me. And I found that being a owner of a business is far more interesting to me than being an operator of a business. So I still run businesses now that are my own, but as far as when it comes to real estate and owning land and renting it out, I spend a lot of my time in the owner's chair as a passive investor now.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm with you. My first investment was also in 2015, and I self-managed at first until I realized I was doing a disservice for the residents because I wasn't doing as good of a job as like a professional property manager with sure. All the systems and everything in place would be able to do. So that became a no-brainer after that. So your investments, are you primarily passive or active or both right now?
I'm an interesting mix. I do both still. I still have the bug. I still like to evaluate deals. And from a GPLP or active passive level, I am a GP still on projects that I usually those are developments. And so these are very long cycle projects. It's not something like I buy an existing place and then suddenly I can do a value add and then I'm doing that play. That's still interesting. And I still do that as an LP, but from a GP's perspective, an active investor, I run a business where I find dirt and get it entitled and then develop it into multifamily. And that pairs nicely with being able to evaluate existing deals and be a limited partner. Or sometimes I help raise capital and bring in other friends of mine that are LPs. And then I become kind of like the investor relations contact. And so I have a GP role in that, but I'm heavily invested on the LP side.
Excellent. And your development deals, are those primarily in Arkansas or elsewhere?
Good question. I focus in Texas. So I have a business partner who lives in Dallas, Texas, and I'm just really big on the Texas market in general. And that I'm really big on the Dallas Fort Worth market. I just found out recently that it is the fourth largest metro, not city, but metro in the US now. It has exceeded Houston as the fourth largest metropolitan area. And it's just growing like leaps and bounds. Like, a lot of people have seen a downturn over the last couple of years. Dallas, and especially, well, Texas hasn't, but especially Dallas has not seen that downturn. It just continues to grow. It's just been a gentle correction, but not any sort of a dip at all.
Excellent. And do you see the population is growing faster than the number of units that are coming in line, or is it about
by quite even? A bit? No. There's a dearth of available housing. There's an overt, definitely a shortage of affordable housing, and our development cycle just cannot keep up with the growth. I really wonder where people just keep having to go further and further out to get some sort of house. And so people are doing a lot of driving in Dallas now.
What sort of multifamily are you developing?
Standard of 1, 2, 3 bedroom apartments. And they're usually what they call in the Texas called the ETJ. And it's outside of a city. And then we work with the city to get it annexed and zoned appropriately. And so we're usually looking for like a Craftsman style. It's a good looking apartment. It's not like cinder block kind of stuff. And we're looking kind of to create community with lots of landscaping and trying to create kind of this village concept. So our first project is called Hidden Creek Village, and it has like a little meandering creek through the middle of the property.
And are you, when you're doing these development deals, are you looking to hold on to them for long-term or sell them once they're fully occupied and such?
So when I can get the zoning for multifamily, then the idea is to keep them for long-term. If sometimes zoning like that doesn't work out very well and you still have a good piece of land, and sometimes that makes sense to do like build-to-rent duplexes or single-family townhomes or garden-style houses. And those we will sell to builders, because I'm not really in the business to be owning 1,000 build-to-rent houses. If I'm going to do that, I'm going to go multifamily because I know it better.
Yep, that's fair. I think it's easier to manage too, because it's kind of all closer together and you get better systems that way too. Mm-hmm. And then as for your passive investments, well, what does your portfolio with that look like?
Well, it's a standard value add projects where other people find a good project that's always in Texas. I'm not interested in going anywhere but Texas because I know the operators there. Because I have a network there, but I'm not attached to just Dallas when I'm doing the an LP role, because I'm not going to create really any value by being there or being nearby sometimes. So if it's in really the dash area, Dallas, Austin, San Antonio, Houston, that triangle, I'm pretty keen on that area because it's growing so much. And that's the kind of projects that I'm involved in from an LP perspective.
Good. And are these through syndication then, I take it?
They're syndications. Sometimes they're 506C, sometimes they're 506B. Just depends on if it's a 506C and they need help raising capital, then I'll come in that regard. If it's just a B, then I'll just be a passive investor.
Okay. And these are all multifamily as well?
All multifamily. Yeah, I'm not doing anything with multifamily.
Yeah. How do you find the sponsors with whom to invest?
Great question. So, since I'm also a sponsor, I have similar interest in kind of questions and want to meet the same people. But I go to basically these multifamily conventions or conferences or capital raising conferences. And when you're an LP in a room like that, you are what people are after. And so it's really interesting to hear people operate. And I don't go in there and say, hey, I'm an LP, I might invest. I go in there as like, yeah, I'm a developer myself, and I'm interested in doing some new projects. And so I'm here to learn, which I am, but I'm also there kind of quietly, which is the way LPs tend to operate, is they're kind of quietly sitting on the side and they're just kind of listening. And you can kind of find the cream of the crop in the room where people who have a lot more experience and have clearly done it for a while, and they exude trustworthiness and track record, then that's typically the kind of people I want to work with.
So it's the track record and trustworthiness. Those are like the two main factors you're looking for in a potential sponsor.
For me, yeah, I want to know that they've been doing this for a while and they have some experience and they have built operations around them, and that when something goes bad, because it's not if, but when something doesn't go to plan, that they're able to deal with it.
How do you find this information out?
Well, a lot of times they're talking about it. You can ask questions, but you're asked like, hey, so like what's, I have a podcast, and so I interview people and I get to know them, and sometimes they need to help raise capital. And so I'll be on the GP team with a small slice, and I get to see firsthand how they operate their business. And so I'm not always an LP in that scenario, but when I can be, and I have some dry powder to deploy, then that's when I'll step in. You know what? I might be able to play it. And this one, I like this deal. The numbers look good. You've clearly done this before. I've seen you operate. I want to be involved in this one.
And so how can you tell if a sponsor is going to do a good job with a particular deal?
Good question. So I like to ask questions like, have you thought about this complication? Like what happens when the taxes go up, when it gets reassessed? What happens, like what kind of insurance do you have, and have you ever had a claim before? And when they tell me answers that as a GP, I've seen other people do, it gives me reason to believe that they've handled difficulty before, that they have a plan, they have surrounded themselves with good people. And I don't like these GP teams that have like 37 GPs and you wonder who in the world in charge. But I also don't like just when there's like one GP and this person has, and maybe they've even done a lot of deals before, but like if something happens to them, where do we, like, that's a single point of failure that makes me really nervous. And so I like to see that they have a team around them that doesn't revolve just on one key person.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then how can a passive investor determine if you and your team are a good match for what they're looking for?
Ask lots of questions. And if you're asking, as an LP, if you're asking questions of GPs and they're not forthcoming, or you just kind of get this vibe that they're frustrated with the questions that you're asking, especially if you're their first time investor, then that's probably an indication that that may not be a good personality fit. And there are personality fits. There are some GPs that don't like to communicate a lot. They like to give quarterly updates and that's that. And if you get requests, they don't have a team set up to handle requests of what's happening. So you also don't want to be that LP that is so annoying that no one wants to work with you, right? So, but you're investing in their project, and you're putting a lot of faith with your cash in their hands to go deploy for you. So I think it's reasonable to ask questions. And once you develop a couple of projects that have gone well, you don't need to ask as many questions. But the first one that you work with somebody, I think it's reasonable to ask questions.
What kind of questions?
So like, what's your track record? What are you going to do when there's a tornado that comes through your place? You know, like, or what if your vacancy isn't as high as you forecast? Like, when you run your models, are you kind of baking in a less than ideal scenario? What happens when interest rates precipitously go up? You know, have you planned for that? That's a question that I hope LPs are asking 2 or 3 years ago and not just now asking because it's already happened.
Mm-hmm. And can you think of any questions that passive investors don't usually ask, but probably should be asking of the sponsors?
A good question for LPs to ask would be if the GP has any cash in the deal, and what are the roles and responsibilities? So I think it's pretty common for LPs to ask if there's skin in the game, but what they don't ask is who's doing what. So that's one thing that I find, that it's often not really certain or well known by a team of GPs, because it's very common for GPs to kind of cobble together a team to take down these big deals. And they'll, you know, this one's doing asset management, these people are doing project management, these people are doing the construction management, and these people are doing the investor relations, exactly. And have they met and talked about what the plan is and who's going to be in charge of what roles? And most of the time I have found that GPs will end up figuring it out, but I feel more comfortable if they've thought about that before I've thought to ask it.
Now, when you're working with the role of investor manager, what kind of support can investors expect from you?
So usually it's updates. And as a investor relations person, you just want to, there's a lot of work to getting the subscription document signed and logged into the portals and updates on what's happened in the project. And that's what the investor relations person is for. And so they're the face of the communications to the LP team. And that's the way I look at it, is like, I'm kind of like the quarterback of the LP team, and I want to make sure that they've gotten a reasonable amount of updates without wearing out the GP. So I'm usually the go-between, and it can be, I'm basically the middleman of information. And you don't want to wear out your GP team, ask them 1,000 questions that aren't helping the project, and you've already invested your capital. Like, you're on the plane. and you can't get off the plane until the GPS decides to land. That's just the way it works, right? So, and so really, you're just like, kind of like the flight attendant. You're like, oh, yeah, this is information that we have. But when you're on a plane and it's not going the way, you're just not taking off. You're on the tarmac and you're sitting there for an hour and a half. And you're like, what in the world is going on? If a little bit of communication makes that process so much more manageable and understandable versus just being left in the dark the whole time.
Mm-hmm. And if a passive investor invests in one of your development deals, what sort of returns can they expect?
It's on a per deal basis, but in our case, we're usually looking at something around 15 to 20% IRR. If it's an existing project where I'm working with another co-sponsor, it's pretty common to be a pref of, you know, 8% and then an IRR of 17%, you know, that it's on a per deal basis, right? But that's very commonly what I'm seeing. When you're dealing with a development project, there's a little more risk, so you expect a little more return.
And then when you're putting these development deals together, like, how do you find the land or you know, kind of the situation where you're like, yes, let's put a deal right here, and this is the right thing to put there?
So that's the fun part for me is, as a developer, I'm looking for the path of progress, which is why I like to stay in my backyard where I operate, which is in primarily Collin County in Dallas, Texas. And it's like the third fastest growing county in the country. Why go anywhere else, right? Texas is a business friendly state, but the only drawback I've found so far with Texas is that it has just high property taxes because there's no income tax. That's the only caveat that I've really found so far. Otherwise, I just love the market. And so when I'm looking for projects, I'm looking for something that is currently agricultural land that has close access to sewer, water, power, and is on a main road or on a road, has access, and then could be converted to multifamily. And usually what I'm looking for is a city that is amenable to that conversation. Some cities are just backwards and just, I mean, like, it just, they just won't play ball. So others will, like, they're looking for the tax revenue and they would love to annex you into the city to get your tax revenue.
Hmm. Yep. That makes sense. What's the problem that you encountered with a real estate investment and how was it handled?
Well, I find that the real estate investment themselves usually are pretty easy to solve. Like that, like, business is easy. People are hard is what I found. And usually it's a partnership that doesn't go to plan. And so when I'm looking to partner, and I'm doing a lot of partnerships in multifamily, it's just, you know, these projects are just too big to take down yourself. So instead what we do is we find partners to work with. And so I want to work with the same people over and over again. I don't have to create this new partnership for every new deal just because they have a good deal. I'd rather work with somebody that has proven themselves as being trustworthy and just do more deals with them. And so what I've seen go badly is not setting clear expectations on the front end, and there being a lot of unsaid assumptions that were realized after the ink was signed, and you're just like this was not on paper anywhere. We didn't talk about this. You, like, an example that recently came up is one person who was a key person and had a lot of information, didn't want to share the information because I think he felt like we were going to like scoop him out of the deal or something, even though he was already inked on the deal. It was very strange. And that's something we should have said beforehand. It's like, very clearly, it's like, once we're in this business marriage, then free information goes everywhere. We're not hiding pieces of information from each other. If you're doing that, then that means you're not a team player, and then you don't need to be on the team.
Yeah, that makes sense. I completely agree with that. You mentioned that you have a podcast. What's it called and what's it about?
So I recently rebranded it. It used to be called My Freedom Foundry, where I was working with and interviewing multifamily investors. And I've talked to so many real estate investors, I kind of got bored with the conversation. So I want to do something a little bit different. I wanted to kind of attract a different audience, or maybe better said, I wanted to evolve with my audience, because after you ask questions about multifamily enough times, you kind of know the answers, and you don't get a lot of new information. But this new branding is called the wake up call. And it's this idea of, is you had an idea about how the world works, and you had this light bulb wake up moment where you realized, oh, like, things operate differently than I expected. Like basically I'm wrong and I have a new set of information that I need to change the way I behaved. And for my wake up call was when I was in the corporate world and I realized, oh my gosh, I've been spending 15 years working in the corporate world and my ladder was against the wrong wall. It's like, dang, I need to reassess how I'm earning my living and providing for my family. And I had to like change industries. And that was a huge wake up call for me and took me some time to process that. I like to see that light bulb moment go off in people's eyes.
Awesome. Well, if you send me a link, I'll include that in the show notes for people to look at.
I will.
Excellent. And you also have another group called Next Level Mastermind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I run my own mastermind where I deal with, or I have a group of people who are existing business owners and they're trying to scale up. So some of them are like, one guy's a YouTube producer. So he helps people produce YouTube channels, but he does real estate on the side. Others are wholesalers and they're transitioning from wholesaling into land flipping or something. And so they're usually there's some sort of transition or a new business they're getting into, and they're trying to learn a real estate related business. And they're trying to scale up and learn how to be a boss and be a leader, which is not something we're taught in school. And is that you really got to kind of figure it out on your own. And it's really helpful to have somebody once a week to say, hey, I'm working on this problem. I'm going through this abatement on this apartment complex and it's just driving me crazy. I just want to talk about it for a while.
Excellent. Yeah, I agree with the, you know, school teaches you to be a good employee, but that doesn't teach you the entrepreneurship
at all.
Yep. Before Robert Kiyosaki wrote Rich Dad Poor Dad, he wrote another book called If You Want to Be Rich and Happy, Don't Go to School.
Which is probably a better name for the book that he wrote with Rich Dad Poor Dad, if you think about it.
Yes, indeed. All right. Are you ready for a speed round?
Let's do it.
What's your favorite part about passive real estate investing?
Being lazy. I like lazy money.
Excellent. What do you know now about passive real estate investing that you wish you knew when you first got started?
Wish I had gotten started earlier. Like this idea of changing from you're exchanging time for money versus money for time. That's the switch that I wish I had developed way earlier.
Yep, me too. What's a book that you can recommend to other investors?
So if you're really getting started into looking at real estate projects, I think The ABCs of Real Estate by Ken McElroy is a really good introductory level book. It's a Rich Dad Poor Dad book, which typically I'm not a big fan of all that branding, but that book happens to be quite good and it's a really good lightweight introductory read.
I agree. I like it a lot as well. How can our listeners get in contact with you if they want to learn more about what you have going on?
Sure. My website's probably the best place to go. PaulDavidThompson.com. It's all of the ways you expect those names to be spelled. I have the curse of a common name, so I had to use all three.
Yeah, I hear you there. Matt Jones is also a common name.
You have a really, really common name.
Yes, indeed. Eventually, I'll be the most famous Matt Jones. That's my goal.
Yeah, clearly.
Yeah. And then is there anything else you want to mention that we haven't covered yet?
Yes, it is within you. You're listening to this because you're looking for a nugget. You're looking for a reason to do something different. And oftentimes you already know what that thing is. You're just looking for some sort of confirmation. So go ahead and take the confirmation. Like right now is the moment to decide that you're worth it and go out and make some mistakes along the way and learn something new and provide value into the marketplace.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you so much, Paul. It's been great having you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Subscribe to this podcast to stay updated on new episodes. Leave a review to let us know that you enjoy the content. There are tons of ways to invest in real estate that you can explore by reading Matt Jones's book called Book About Real Estate. It summarizes many top real estate books all in one. Find it on Amazon, Audible, iTunes, Google Play, or BarnesandNoble.com. If you want to learn more about passive real estate investing, go to HawkWingCapital.com.